Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Triangulation, episode 172, recorded October 20th, 2014. Borg like me. Triangulation is brought to you by NatureBox. NatureBox ships great-tasting, wholesome snacks right to your door. Forget the vending machine. Start snacking smarter with wholesome, delicious treats like pumpkin spice nom-noms. Maybe. To get your free NatureBox sampler box, go to naturebox.com/twit. That's naturebox.com/twit. And by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. And by Personal Capital. With Personal Capital, you'll finally have all your financial life in one place and get a clear view of everything you own. Best of all, it's free. To sign up, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. It's time for Triangulation, the show where we get some of the most interesting people in technology to talk to us about their lives, their ideas, the future. It's always so much fun. And an old friend is here today, a guy I've known, well, back since the Tech TV days. He actually wrote one of my books, the book about TiVo. Leo Laporte's Guide to TiVo, which Leo Laporte had very little to do with. And he's been a writer for a very long time, and his new volume, Borg Like Me, is a compilation of articles, stories, tales from his 30 years as a writer. Gareth Branwen, it's so nice to see you. Welcome.
It's great to see you again, Leo.
It's been a long time, my friend, but I have never stopped following your work. And it's easy because you've been writing in Wired, Boing Boing, Mondo 2000. I loved the jargon watch you used to do for Wired.
Yeah, I did that for 12 years.
That was fun.
Yeah, no, that was great. And that's when we met through that, because I used to be on Screensavers, and I'd beam in from my home, and that horrible web TV at the time. Half the time I'd be frozen.
It's still that way, by the way. We had that happen earlier today.
It hasn't gotten a lot better.
Much better.
Yeah, I used to come on, I think, every month and do like the top jargon terms for quite a while.
It's really fun. Really loved that. And you're just one of the... You're one of the guys that everybody universally say, oh, he's one of the sweetest guys in technology, one of the guys you want to just kind of follow and keep up with, because you're always doing something interesting. Tell me about this. First of all, you can't get it in the bookstores. It's very modern that way. Amazon or on your website.
Yeah, I wanted to, you know, I was at Make magazine for 8 years. Finally, I was the editorial director there.
You left, though.
Yeah, I left in 2013 and early 2013, and I've been wanting to do this book for ages, and just that job was just so large. I knew that I could never do the book while maintaining that job, so I left. I wanted this book to be an experiment in crowdfunding, self-publishing, and a printing on demand. And so,
oh, interesting.
Yeah, so this book is completely done by me from start to finish. I mean, I had a lot of friends contribute to it. It was also an exercise in going, sort of harkening back to my zine days through early Boing Boing, and I put out a zine in the 90s called Going Gaga, which is how Mark Frauenfelder and I met. Mm-hmm. And so I wanted to sort of recapture some of that early internet spirit and early publishing spirit. So I went back to all the original illustrators that I worked with over the years. So there are 30 illustrations in there.
They're really great.
People like Mark Frauenfelder and Danny Hellman, who I work with at Boing Boing. So it was really an experiment. Like, are these technologies ready for prime time? Crowdfunding, printing on demand, self-publishing. And the one thing I know is that printing on demand is amazing. I mean, look at the quality of that.
Yeah.
I was really concerned about the blacks, like how the blacks would print. And, they're showing now. This is a walkthrough that I did on YouTube of the book.
It's just beautiful. I mean, first of all, you'd never know that this was in any way not a traditional book.
That was my goal. Make it indistinguishable.
Yeah. And it certainly helps that you have the background. You know all the illustrators. You're a great writer. You've been writing for years.
You don't need an editor, probably, as way some younger writers
might. Yeah, I have one just because I have a hard time seeing my own mistakes. Right, but right. A copy
but
editor.
But you outsource that, right? I mean,
well, through friends. I mean, I did it all through my friend network.
But anybody could do that, right?
Yeah,
nowadays.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. And that's the one thing. Like with Kickstarter, I know so much about publishing, media contacts and stuff. So people who don't have all of that skill and network, I don't know how they successfully do Kickstarter, because I worked my butt off for 30 days to get my Kickstarter. I made close to $22,000 in 30 days.
Well, and you had a network already, right? I think that's something that we have learned here, too, that people say, well, how do you start something like Twit? And you don't just start it out of nowhere. You couldn't do this out of nothing.
Exactly.
It takes years of making connections, building a community, getting to know things. It's kind of almost the crowning achievement in your case 30 years as a writer, right?
Right, yep.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So why did you kickstart it? Your Kickstarter was last year. You funded in August.
Yeah, exactly. Because I wanted, again, it was an experiment. I actually had a publisher when I started talking
about this. So you could have gone to Little Brown.
Yeah, no, I had somebody approach me immediately when I started talking to on Facebook that said they would be interested in looking at the proposal. And I really wanted to do it all myself. This is my eighth book. I've never really been that happy with the production of the books. The cover's never been the cover that
Tell
I wanted.
Me about it.
And
yeah.
So yeah, it was just that thing of I want to take control of the entire process and see what I would come up with and see, is it more gratifying than the traditional process? Do you make as much money, more money? Are these technologies really ready for prime time? So it was all sort of a fun experiment.
So a year after you funded, or a little less, the book came out. Is that right?
It came out in
July.
July.
So it takes a while.
Yeah, it was 9 months of work to get the book actually
you'd written all the content already, yeah?
Well, most of it. Not really. I mean, what I tried to do with this book is I didn't want it to just be a collection of my best work. I really tried to, I call it a lazy man's memoirs, because what I did is created deep introductions to all the pieces that try to put the pieces in the context, like what was going on in my life, what was going on in digital culture at the time, and then I sort of backfilled it with new essays,
right,
which talk about my own life and my relationship with my wife and the death of my wife. So I got a lot of very personal things. Yeah, people read this and they think it's a tech book.
Yeah.
Some guy posted on my Facebook wall, he went, I just read By This River, which is about the death of my wife, and he says, I didn't know I was signing up for heart-rending. But yeah, so it's a memoir, really, but built around my existing content.
Yeah. Your wife died in 2005.
Yep.
Yeah. But you know what's great? Your son lives near here, one of your sons.
He just won, yeah.
You just have one.
Blake, yeah.
He lives near here. He's a game designer.
Yep.
And so life goes on.
Oh, yeah. No, he's an amazing guy. I mean, we came through a very dark, scary period. But we sort of clung on to each other, and he's just a brilliant guy. And, yeah, he's gone on to do amazing things and seems, reasonably healthy throughout, going through something so
Pam would be harsh. Very proud, I'm sure.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah. Totally.
So I want to talk about the contents of the book, but I think it is the meta story of the book itself is actually quite fascinating. We'll talk more about the contents in a little bit. Would you say this is a success? The experiment is a success?
Everything so far except the
monetary
success.
The money, so the money you raised, little more than $20,000, went to the production of the book?
I hired a designer and a cover designer and an editor. I mean, I didn't pay them what they were worth. They were all friends.
Did you cut them in on the sales or?
No. what sales?
Okay, so we're going to sell a whole bunch of them right now.
Please.
That's what we're going to do.
I can tell you that it's amazing the people who have read it. Like I've had people like Tom Igo, the co-creator of the Arduino, which is basically the engine of the maker movement, come up to me and said, without you and Mark Fraunfelder, you guys inspired me to be who I am.
I agree.
So that's crazy. And he loves the book. And so to have people like that be really moved by my book, it's a success as far as I'm concerned, if it doesn't, you know, even break even. But
so you're not even breaking even at this point?
Not yet, no. I mean, no. It's building momentum, which I think, you know, for self-published books, it has a completely different arc than the traditional publishing. It's a slow rise and then a long tail.
Because word of mouth ultimately is what
sells
a book like this, as opposed to a book tour or billboards and, you know, Sunset Strip.
Yeah, no, that's the one thing you really miss when you do self-publishing. You don't have that whole sort of engine of the publishing empire that immediately gets the word out to everyone and gets a book in every store, and you miss all of that. So.
Well, that's true of music. It's true of everything now is that, you know, you have to ask, what does a publisher or what does a music publisher add, a record label add to the process? Nowadays, it's not the creation of the of the item. It's marketing.
Yeah, no, absolutely,
It's the clout to get it. But there aren't any bookstores anymore.
Yeah, well, so, there's that.
what you know, do you think that this would sell better if it were in bookstores?
No, not appreciably, no.
Oh.
I mean, I am really going to try to get it in, like, Borderlands in San Francisco. Pick a couple of specialty.
Independent bookstores.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Stacy's, oh, that's gone. Powell's.
Yeah, Copperfield's.
Copperfield's here in Petaluma.
Yeah, I might go. I think the office is in Sebastopol.
Yeah, there's several Copperfields.
Yep.
And because, you worked at Make Magazine, you know, Sebastopol. There's Santa Rosa, Sebastopol, Petaluma. And that's really the model now for bookstores. The chains are kind of gone, but that's fine with me. They only carried 1,000 titles anyway.
Yeah,
it'd be hard to get into a chain. There's a Book Passage in Corte Madera.
Mm-hmm.
I know Elaine Petrocelli would love to carry your book and maybe even have you do a reading. I'll connect you.
Oh, cool. That'd be great.
Because I think that's what your journey is for the next year or so, right?
Absolutely.
Is how do we get this in stores? Are you going to go back to work? Are you going to take assignments?
Well, yeah. I mean, I've been doing consulting work. I do editing for other people. I'm working for Make again, working on their I've done some articles for them for the magazine. And I'm also working on their Maker Shed website.
Do you are you a maker yourself? I mean, or you cover the maker movement, you think?
Well, both. I mean, it was funny for a while when I would go to Dorkbots or other events and you go around, you say, you know, what you make. And I would say, I make magazines about people making things because that's basically what my job became.
Yeah.
But before that, I was a robot builder. I mean, I wrote a book called The Absolute Beginner's Guide to Building Robots before you and I worked on the TiVo book.
That's right.
And I'm sort of known for being a robot guy. I have a couple of pieces in the book about robot building.
Yeah. Love robots. Robots.
I have a proposal out there now to do another robot book. Which
Mark
would be really
Pauline
fun.
Lives down the street.
We've
him on
I know
the show.
Mark,
there's a character.
Yeah.
I don't know if you call his robots or what.
Yeah,
they're not autonomous.
They're killing art machines.
That's probably a better description. I want to ask you about your wristwatch, too, in just a second. But first, snack time. Do you mind?
No.
Do you like snacks? Are you a fan?
I love snacks.
We have our sponsor is Nature Box, and these guys, they deliver snacks to your door once a month. You got three different box sizes you can choose from and more than 100 different snacks. And I always like opening up my Nature Box. We get several of them here at the studio every month because our staff loves them. So the idea is nutritionists design these: no high fructose corn syrup, no artificial colors, no artificial flavors, zero trans fats, good stuff. They have vegan, gluten conscious, no sugar, things like that. So if you've got dietary needs, you can satisfy those with a variety of snacks. And we're going to get you a sampler so you can try some of the different snacks. But just as an example, the Lone Star Snack Mix, which is barbecue flavored nut mix with multi-seed chips. This is the best dried pineapple in the world. The Big Island pineapple rings. Love these.
Yeah, those are great.
Oh, and they're chewy. Would you like some?
Sure.
Yeah, here, have that. They come in a resealable bag. So you can have one, seal it back up. Yeah, see, just tear it right open, seal it right back up. You don't have to feel that you need to eat the entire bag, but you might want to because they're very, very good. Go to naturebox.com. Start your free trial today. Choose from savory, sweet, or spicy, or get a complete assortment. You're going to love those. They are, but I warn you, they're, you're not, okay, we won't be talking to you for a minute. Very chewy. I love them.
Carry on, Lisa.
Carry on. I'll just keep doing the end. Naturebox.com/twit to get, do at least get your free sampler. I think you'll be very glad.
Oh, yeah, those are yummy.
Aren't they good?
Very good.
And there's no sulfites. I mean, this is just high quality stuff. I really like it that about them. Naturebox.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support. We're talking to Gareth Branwyn, old friend, creator, maker, robot builder. Book is called Borg Like Me, and it was an experiment in self-publishing. He did it all himself, even down to the Kickstarter campaign. Gosh, I there's so much I want to talk to you. Let's talk about zines.
Oh, yeah.
That's where you started.
Yep.
That was an interesting movement, pre-internet.
Yep.
Although they took to the internet very well. What were zines?
Zines were small, I think very much driven by the desktop publishing revolution of the 80s. Zines were these small desktop printed publications because things like PageMaker had just come out,
right.
And
the laser
desktop
writer.
Copiers were affordable, and the laser writer, you could do decent type. I mean, I can tell you from my own experience, my wife and I had a graphic design business, and so we bought all that stuff for our graphic design business, and I had all these toys, and so I just thought, I want to do something fun. I don't want to do another business card for a local, you know, farmer or whatever. I want to do something interesting. So I made this little zine called Going Gaga.
It wasn't about Lady Gaga. She wasn't around.
No, no. Oh, but I actually have a thing. I put out for issue number 5 of Going Gaga, it was an art issue, and I issued a thing called the Gaga Manifesto.
Ooh.
And in the Gaga Manifesto, it said, you know, because Duchamp had this thing called the Ready Made. Was it Duchamp? I think it was just Marcel Duchamp had the thing called a ready-made where he just would take like a bottle rack and turn it upside down and make it into an art piece. And the toilet, the inverted toilet was his famous one.
Yeah.
So I came up with the Gaga version of that was that anything that had Gaga in the title was instantly a Gaga ready-made. So when Lady Gaga came on the scene, I immediately started telling people, she is a Gaga, you know, she's one of my art creations because her name is Lady Gaga. So by nature of that
you created Lady Gaga, and I bet you she knew that. Do you think you should ask her? I bet you she...
Everyone tells me that. They think probably she's probably cool enough that she would kind of like that.
Yeah.
But her people might not like it.
The people.
Yep.
Here's the Duchamp fountain. And this is at the Tate Modern in London.
Yep.
So this is, you know, just because he took a urinal and turned it sideways doesn't mean it's not art. I got to tell you.
Well, it's, you know, the whole Dada thing was really beautiful because it was about this sort of modern rethinking.
You
of
remember
everything.
Picasso's bull with the bicycle seat and the handlebars.
Yeah.
It's amazing. It's like.
And I think Duchamp also had a stool with a bicycle wheel on it, was one of his pieces.
So zines were kind of, they were fan driven.
Yeah, I mean,
fanzines, though.
Well, originally they started off as science fiction fanzines
The
30s and 40s,
right.
I think. They were like mimeographed or whatever.
Right.
But that evolved into the punk scene, and there were punk zines. And I got in sort of at the end of that where it was just anything. So my zine was basically art and technology, explored that. And then that's how I got hooked up with Mark Fraunfelder because... My zine ended up in Fact Sheet 5, which was like this directory of zines at the time. And I was scanning down the thing, and I saw that a magazine called Boing Boing, and mine is Going Gaga. So I thought, I bet you I would like this guy. So I read the little description, and I was fascinated by cyberpunk at the time, and it had cyberpunk as one of the things they covered. So we exchanged, and I just found the original letter that he sent to me. So we started exchanging zines, and then when my zine folded, I started working for Boing Boing.
People, I don't think, know that Boing Boing was a paper publication.
Very few people know that,
And
I think we did like 13 issues.
Yeah.
And it got very, by the end of it, it was a pretty slick little magazine, a pretty wide circulation. And
this is about the time that the well is starting to emerge.
Yep.
And it's not quite the internet yet, but people are starting to share this stuff online. And you were involved in the well.
And all of my jobs came through the well. Like, because when I started circulating Going Gaga, I started getting email from Kevin Kelly, Are You Serious, Eric Davis from The Village Voice saying, oh, I got your zine, I love it. And they started writing reviews of it. And then Kevin asked me to write for Whole Earth Review because of it. And so I started, and then Are You Serious asked me to write for Mondo because, but that was all through. Well, Are You Serious was at my talk at Long Now last night, and I was telling
he's still around.
Yeah, he's still around, and I was telling people, it's like, Are You Serious and I met in a closet in Sausalito, California, because they had, you know, the Well was a mini computer in the closet of the Whole Earth offices. So all of these people I met inside a closet in Sausalito in like 1991.
I was there too, but I was hiding in the closet. I didn't really, but yeah, I remember what an exciting time that was.
Oh, it was amazing.
On the Well. And it was just amazing. Text. It wasn't. You know, but if you'd used Genie or CompuServe, you kind of understood what the commercial world was like.
Right.
But then you did the Well, and it was all these very interesting, passionate people talking about the things they were interested in.
I actually believe that historically that the Well is going to be remembered as a real linchpin in the entire birth of the internet, digital culture, all of the because you had engineers hanging out on there, you had people from NASA Ames, you had people from Mondo, Wired,
Deadheads,
early Wired.
Yeah.
Every
kind of person.
Yep. Yeah. And the amazing thing is I remember when it before it was actually called the internet. I remember a conversation on Usenet where we were actually discussing what to call the internet. And the three
was
WorldNet, Internet, and the Matrix.
It's the Matrix, baby.
Wouldn't it be amazing if the Matrix had caught on and we were living in the Matrix?
We're
now
in the Matrix. The first experience I had of the internet was on the Well because you could drop out of the it was basically text-based messaging. It was much like a forum, sort of.
Confer, I think, was the system.
Yeah, and you could drop out of it to a Unix prompt.
Yep.
And from there, use Archie and Gopher and Lynx.
Oh, yeah, absolutely, yep.
And I was, like, blown away. I was like, there's a whole bunch of people all over the world on this system. And it very much felt like the Matrix, like you had suddenly, your eyes had suddenly opened.
Oh, yeah, it was amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that we've actually done, we've interviewed Kevin Kelly. We've talked about the Well before on the show a few times with early Well folks. And I think probably a lot of the younger people watching think, well, it's just a bunch of old farts reminiscing about the good old days before the internet. But really, it was something happening.
Oh, yeah.
It was the seeds of the internet.
Absolutely. To me, it was also it's sort of like the Parisian salons with Alice B. Toklas and what was her name?
Picasso was there. Gertrude Stein. We were all there.
those people really sort of created modern art and culture in a lot of ways through those salons.
Right.
And there was also ones in New York. And I think the Well will be remembered as sort of the salon of
Hemingway,
of this
F.
era.
Scott Fitzgerald. Yep. Yeah. Yeah, this was the, instead of the roaring 20s, the roaring 90s.
Exactly.
And a very interesting time. And of course, like all online communities, it finally just descended into flame wars and link bait.
Yeah, and I never go back to the Well anymore.
No, it's still around.
Yeah, oh,
you can still log in.
It's web-based now. It's
right.
Not. But one of the things, an interesting takeaway for people that have read my book, something I didn't intend to put in there, but just because it's based on this content that I wrote in the roaring 90s, one of the big takeaways is that we've lost sort of the early passion for this technology and the internet and the potential of the technology. Like pretty much everyone who's read the book, that's one of the things that they take away from it. And I think that's wonderful in this day of, the threat of the loss of net neutrality and things like that. To be reminded of what the original intent of all this stuff was.
Because we still can steer it. It's not baked, even though commercial interests have taken it over. There really is still a lot. It is a place to gather and create.
Oh, yeah.
There's
still amazing stuff going on.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Get inspired and read the book, Borg Like Me. That's the solution. So people should go to your website, which is sparksoffirepress.com, and they can buy it there. And you have packages that include, autographed copies and stuff.
Oh, yeah, and I have all kinds of little goodies that you get.
I want to encourage people to do that and to buy the book. If you're interested in this kind of notion of bringing the art back into the internet and bringing the creative culture back, and the art could be making, it could be it could be painting, it could be drawing, it could be sculpture, it could be writing, of course. You have an article about the Jargon Watch and your favorite phrases from Jargon Watch.
Yeah, that was an interesting thought because after doing the Jargon Watch column for 12 years and then stepping away from it, I just thought, what are the terms that I covered back then that I still use that have actually become part of my personal lexicon? So I went through the jargon list.
Because a lot of them, that was it. That was their 15 minutes. They were gone by the time you wrote about them, it was over.
There's actually a term that I call stunt words, which are just words that are coined in a moment, and they don't stick, but they're relevant to the moment that they're coined.
Brain fart?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Brain fart's a long-term one.
Ego surfing.
Ego surfing is interesting because that's actually a term that's now in the Oxford Dictionary, and it was coined by a friend of mine, but it's actually about me. It's my ego.
You're the first?
I am the first.
So that's typing your name into Google, basically.
Yeah, because a friend of mine, we were working on this book called The Mosaic Quick Tour, which is the first book about the World Wide Web.
Wow.
And he was my researcher, and so he calls me up one day and he says, what are you doing? I said, oh, I'm on the internet searching for instances of my own name. I think it was actually before Google. And he goes, God, I do that all the time too. Like once a week, I'll see like what people are saying about me. He said, there should be a word for that. And I said, I know, there really should be. And so he calls me back like 15 minutes later and he just goes, ego surfing. So I put it in the column. I didn't usually do words like that were just coined by somebody. That weren't. I had to find three instances of them. But I just thought that was so great. And now it's in the Oxford Dictionary.
It's real.
But at one point I realized, oh, God, it's my ego.
It's you! Gareth Branwyn's with us, the inventor of ego surfing. Bit flip. That's a good one. Bio break. Still use that
bathroom,
one.
Bathroom, yeah.
Yep. I've never used hand salsa, but that's the gunk that's on the joystick after particularly heady round.
Just sweat through a game.
Interrupt driven. I like that.
Oh, yeah. That's a great one.
So PepCac was originally publicized in the
Actually from the jargon. There's a few of those, like brain fart is from the jargon file. Eric Raymond did
Raymond,
in the Hacker's Dictionary.
Yeah.
Which is actually how I got the gig doing the Jargon Watch column in Wired, is that I did a piece about him and the new Hacker Dictionary in Mondo 2000, and Kevin Kelly called me up and said, this is really awesome. Would you like to do this regularly for Wired? So then we created the Jargon Watch column in response to that, basically.
So this is another thing I think the young people don't know, but before there was Condé Nast Wired, there was the original Wired, which was a heck of a lot bizarrer.
Yeah.
But before there was that,
there was
Mondo
bizarre.
2000, which was truly weird.
Yep.
And very much a spin-off of the zine scene.
Oh, yeah.
That's but intended to be a real glossy magazine.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it started off as High Frontiers, which was this funky newspaper print, and then they became Reality Hackers, which was very similar to by the time that Boing Boing ended. It was like that quality color cover and then sort of cheap paper inside. But then, then they came out of the gate with this beautiful art magazine called Mondo 2000, which was, I just read a quote where some guy said, when you got an issue of Mondo 2000, it went aflame in your hands.
It did. That's a very apt description. So when did Mondo 2000 start? It was in 89, I think. 89?
I think back with High Frontiers and stuff, I think it was 90, I can't remember, early 90s
early
when it
90s.
Actually became Mondo 2000, which is really what put it on the map.
And it was Are You Serious?
Yeah.
Not his real name.
No. Are you serious?
Are you serious?
It's not.
But apparently he still goes by that, which is kind of interesting.
He had a big kerfuffle with Facebook because they don't allow him to use his name. So it's his name is Ken Goffman. So it's Ken Are You Serious Goffman
his
Facebook name.
They just take all the fun out of everything, don't they?
Went over to Halo for a moment. For a day.
For a day. So did you write for them from the beginning, or how did that work out?
I wrote for Wired from the second issue for 12 years forward, and I'm actually the only person that was ever in every single issue of Wired from 2 to whatever the last
issue.
You're
the Dick DiBartolo of Wired magazine is what
even
you are.
Jane and Lewis
they
left.
They even weren't in all
of them. Yeah, they were gone by the time I was
the Rosettos.
Still there.
And Mondo 2000, what did you did write for them as well, right?
Yeah, no, I was a section editor for them.
Really?
For most of its run.
What section?
I've done a thing called Street Tech, which I actually started, where did I actually first use it? I think maybe in Going Gaga. I had a column called Street Tech, and then I moved that over to the Whole Earth Millennium Whole Earth Catalog. I wrote a section called Street Tech. And then I moved that over. So it was this thing that sort of migrated. And then I moved it over to Monitor 2000. So I did a column called Street Tech, which basically was maker stuff. It was
right.
about people doing little tiny satellite, micro satellites and cool people making weird tech. I've been a hardware hacker since way before other people. When in the 90s, I was doing hardware hacking, and all of my hacker friends who were all software hackers, I would say, you can replace your power supply on your PC. And they would go like, oh, my God, no.
Don't touch that!
You're
PC. Crazy!
Are you kidding me? But yeah, I was messing with things like the 68HC11, the early microcontrollers, which were way hard to use and large, but sort of progenitors of things like the Arduino today.
Before you were hacking the TiVo, you were hacking your VCR.
Yeah, exactly.
Not as easy to hack. Wow. We're talking to Gareth Branwen. You've got to get his book. The new book is Borg Like Me. It's available at Sparks of Fire Press or Amazon. You're going to get it at Amazon.
Yeah, it's on Amazon as well, yeah.
But get it from the source. I like getting it from the source. How often can you buy a book from the author? That's a nice
Well, feeling. And if you buy it from me, I autograph it. I give you the book plate, the little
bookmark. I love the book plate. Oh, and the Moo. It's like a Moo card, the bookmark.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, because
like
I collect bookmarks. I have a large bookmark collection, and most of them, they're this long, and so they hang out of your book. They get
this
all
is
bent.
Perfect.
And that's all you really need for a bookmark.
It's like a Moo card. It probably is a Moo card, right? Or something
yeah, they're
like
Moo cards, yeah.
Yeah.
And I did Moo cards of all the illustrations in the book. So
neat. So you get a little baby version of the illustration as your bookmark. So get it from Sparks of Fire Press. And it says, Gareth Branwen, writer, editor, professional bohemian. What is the watch? Is that a Braille watch?
This is a Tokyo Flash watch, which is a company that, I don't know, like 10 years ago, as watches were starting to die, people didn't wear watches anymore. They had the brilliant idea of getting artists to design watches. Every watch that they sell tells time in a completely different way.
Of course it
does. So this one has, these are, and unfortunately the battery is dead. I got to change the battery, but these are the hours, these are the tens, and these are the minutes.
The dots on it. Can you read it? Are you able to read it?
Oh, yeah. No, it's
if it were
once
working.
You learn, that's the beautiful thing about, the human brain. It's like once you train yourself.
It's just as easy as anything else.
Exactly. And some of them do have their binary watches that
these
show
are
you
cool.
the time in binary. And
they're not like super expensive either.
They're very affordable. At one point I had three of them, but one died and I lost the other
one. So the battery's dead on that? Or
yeah. Unfortunately, because if you press the button, it does an LED, super bright LED light show that's different every single time.
Wow. But you still wear it just because you like it?
Well, because everyone asked me about it, so it's a conversation. Yeah, somebody asked me during the Q&A last night at the Long Now. Somebody said, "What? Tell us about your watch.
Why is it? We like watches.
Yeah.
There's something about watches.
Apple is banking on
They're
that.
Counting on it. Even though nobody wears them, we like them. I'm going to get some Tokyo Flash watches. These are cool. It's TokyoFlash.com.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Yeah, I did a piece in Make about them called Tokyo Time Hacking. Because I just love the idea. Like Cory Doctorow from Boing Boing is a big Tokyo Flash watch, and he has a whole
surprise.
Bunch of them, and he's a watch collector. But the idea of wearing a different Tokyo Flash watch every day, so somebody says, what time is it? It's like, wait, what time technology?
How do I read this? I want this one, the radioactive LED watch. It shows it looks like a Geiger counter. This will scare the pants off people who see this.
Well, after 9/11, I had one of their watches that had, it looked exactly like a radar dial, pressed it actually went around and then it landed on the hour, and so I was terrified about taking it through TSA because I just thought they're going to think it's like I'm going to launch a missile. It's like a sort of James Bond device.
What is that? Of course it doesn't look like any watch you ever saw, but these are all very cool, very interesting. We're talking with Gareth Branwen, writer, creator, new bohemian, and we'll have more with Gareth in just a little bit. Our show today brought to you by prosper.com. A very cool idea. Hacking the banking system. That's Silicon Valley's great at kind of taking existing businesses and reinventing them. In this case, the small loan, the personal loan. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace. So they bring people with money to lend together with people who need money to borrow in a marketplace. Now, of course, because of banking regulations and stuff, they've got it all wired so it's safe and easy to use and all of that stuff. But the whole idea is so great. No more going to a bank hat in hand. You got to put on pants and a necktie and all. You don't have to do that anymore. You just go to prosper.com. In fact, if you go to prosper.com/twit, you can start right now. You get your rate and quote based on just a few. You don't have to give them a whole bunch of information. Just a couple of things. It won't affect your credit score. If what would you do if you get $35,000 in 72 hours? Would you write a book? You might. That's more than you got from Kickstarter. Yeah, write a book. Publish your own book. Would you pay off high interest credit cards or maybe do some home improvement? All you have to do is visit prosper.com/twit. These are low fixed rate, unsecured personal loans. You don't need to provide collateral. Multi-year terms are available. It is a really clever idea. No outrageous fees, no rising interest rates, and you'll never set foot in a bank. For a limited time, Prosper is offering Twit viewers a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get that loan. Go to prosper.com/twit. That's a site just for you. Prosper.com/twit. Get up to $35,000 in just 3 days plus the $50 Visa prepaid card. What a great idea. Prosper.com/twit. When you say new Bohemian, that's interesting. The Bohemian era was in the 50s. But actually, there were Bohemians. The Bohemian Club in San Francisco goes back to the turn of the last century. Bohemians have always been the artistic types, right? La Bohème.
Yeah. I think I may have actually swiped that from Bruce Sterling. I think Bruce Sterling
started using that. Is he a professional Bohemian as well?
He started using that term Bohemian to sort of describe, you know, fringe culture, underground culture or whatever. And I've never been a joiner, so I never really know what to, you know,
You're not in a club.
Yeah, I was never a hippie, but I lived in a hippie commune.
Is that how you grew up, in a commune?
Yeah, I moved there when I was 17, Twin Oaks community.
Oh, you didn't grow up there. You were a communard.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, I moved there when I was 17.
So were your parents, you grew up in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
Were your parents fairly straight?
Yes, very much so. Conservative, Catholic.
The more straight. The
yeah,
parents, the more
a,
twisted
a very
the tree.
Strict Southern Baptist town.
Uh-huh.
And so I was this really nerdy kid. And I had arthritis back then, too, so I couldn't do sports. And it was completely Friday Night Lights. If you didn't play sports, you were just sort of a blank. You didn't
right.
kind of exist.
Right.
So I just spent all my time in my room reading science fiction and weird occult things. And that's pretty much how I formed
Lovecraft kind of stuff? Or
oh, yeah. Yeah,
H.P.
all
Lovecraft?
That stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Tons of sci-fi. I just burned through like two or three sci-fi books a week.
We're all in that club. I think almost everybody who watches is in that club.
But right? I did want to be a hippie. I thought I wanted to be a hippie, and I was terrified that by the time I graduated from high school, the hippies would be gone.
Well, you're probably roughly my age. We were kind of towards the tail end of it.
Yeah, I graduated in 1975.
Yeah, 73.
Yep.
So it was like, they're gone.
Yep.
But you found a commune.
But I found there was an article in the Richmond paper about this commune called Twin Oaks, and there's a bunch of long-haired hippies there, and I just thought, that's where I want to go. So,
because that'll make my parents madder than anything.
Well, what's really amazing is my parents ended up encouraging me, and they actually went to the school, and they said, we're going to be moving, which was completely not true, but we want him to graduate in this school. So I skipped the 11th grade, and I graduated a year early.
Same thing.
But what's interesting is I think they made a bet, because I think they thought he's a really smart kid. Smart people go to college. You
right.
know, you've got to be a doctor or a lawyer or an engineer
right.
or something. So he'll go to this thing. He won't like it because smart people go to college, and he'll be there for a year or so. He'll come out. He'll be right on track to go to school. And I was there for 6.5
he'll
years.
He'll grow out of it. Every parent says that. Oh, yeah. He'll grow out of it.
Yeah. So they.
So wow, you really became a hippie.
Yeah. So I lived on a commune,
but there's no technology in a commune.
Well, Twin Oaks is an interesting because it was started by a bunch of academics. So it was very much. It wasn't really a hippie. I mean, people had long hair and stuff. It's very organized. It was very intellectual.
Sounds
culture.
Fun.
What's that?
Sounds like fun.
Oh, it was great.
I want to go now.
Oh, yeah, no, I feel so blessed that I grew up in an environment like that.
That was your college in a way.
Oh, absolutely. And what's amazing is I was 17 years old, and because it's an egalitarian community, everyone's supposed to be treated equally, they treated me as an equal adult, and I was so full of myself that I started a business at 17. I had a budget. I had a couple of employees. And by 18, I was the co-manager of the hammock business, which was the lifeblood of the community.
Wow.
So they entrusted us. Probably I was 18 at that time, an 18-year-old kid. If I had screwed something up and we had like Pier 1 was our largest contract, and it was like 85% of our income. So if I had like screwed up something with Pier 1 and we lost that contract, the community would basically die. So it's really awesome looking back that they entrusted me, and I performed. I did what I was supposed to do and kept the business going. And I worked with my co-manager was this absolutely brilliant guy who did all the accounting and all the sort of real managerial stuff. But
so it's interesting. So you had a business mind. I mean, you wanted to be a writer, but you had a business mind as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've always had that.
I don't think you could do this if you didn't have that kind of organizational ability.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of moving parts to do something like this. It's kind of staggering how many different things you've got to be juggling and different skill sets you've got to have.
I really love the book because it's for me a little memory lane, but also inspiration for how it should be today still. It's very exciting, and making the maker movement is just one aspect of the whole thing. And in a way, it very much is that hippie culture. I think, you know, John Markoff, I think, wrote a book, What the Dormouse Said, something like that, about how the counterculture of the 60s really in many ways spawned the tech revolution
Absolutely.
Of the 80s.
Absolutely.
Steve Jobs was a hippie, right?
Yeah.
And it's in a similar sense. I mean, Steve was a very young guy, and Nolan Bushnell just kind of said, well, you smell funny, but I you seem smart. I'm going to trust you, very much like you were trusted.
Yep.
Go ahead. You have to work nights because nobody can stand you. But I'm going to trust you. And I think that that's the story across the board with a lot of these.
Mitch Altman, who was one of the co-founders of NoiseBridge, the hackerspace in San Francisco, was at my talk last night. We were talking afterwards, and he was talking about just the beauty of these hackerspaces where people can come in. There are engineers and trained people, but these self-taught, you know, these autodidacts come in, and they just make amazing things, and they're given the license to do that. So it's the same thing. You give these people tools, and they emerge into themselves, and you get things like, you know, MakerBot. I mean, Bree Pettis was a high school teacher. He wasn't an engineer or whatever, and he created, well, with other people, but he created MakerBot, which is, again, one of the real engines of the maker movement is 3D printing, personal 3D printing.
We actually talked about that last week with the documentarians who'd made it's on Netflix right now. Documentary about this.
Oh, Print the Legend?
Yeah.
Oh, God, that's an intense...
What do you think about that? Because one of the side effects of that movie is Bree kind of goes through this story arc that maybe isn't so appealing by the end.
Oh, yeah, no, it's shocking. I mean, I know Bree. And I think, you know, my feeling is that Bree is a really lovely person.
I've always thought that. He's one of the sweet guys, like Mark Fraunfelder, like Corey. Smart, but gentle.
And he's very childlike.
Yeah.
And so I think you take someone who has that really fundamental childlike enthusiasm and creative energy, and then you make them a CEO of a company that has tons of pressure, and maybe what you see in that movie is what happens to someone with that kind of pressure.
The story's not over.
Yeah, no, and the story's definitely not over. Yeah, but bless him and MakerBot for creating that. You know,
I don't think the
personal 3D printing revolution would be as we wouldn't be as deep into it without the.
I completely agree.
The work that they did.
Yeah. What's your favorite essay in the book?
Well, last night I read a one called Tears in the Rain, which is a piece that I wrote for Boing Boing. They did a series called Mind Blowing Movies, and it's about Blade Runner. Like when they asked
the end of it, they're raining, and
And when they asked me to do it, the first movie that popped in my head was Blade Runner, but thinking for the Boing Boing audience, that's kind of a warhorse film to cover. So I just decided to cover my personal story of what happened around that and how that movie really was the beginning of my kind of molting into this kind of cyber culture guy. Yeah, kind of. Exactly.
Kind of. A Nexus 7. Or is it a Nexus 6, right?
And then another one that I think is an interesting for a lot of would be interesting for a lot of people is the Billy Idol story because
play Billy Idol.
And I actually used to impersonate Billy Idol in cyberspace. Billy got hooked up, got on the well because he came to me because he wanted to use something that I wrote in Mondo 2000 on his cyberpunk record. And then he went to Mark Fraunfelder because Mark Fraunfelder was local. And Billy wanted to do everything himself. He wanted to do the album cover.
Wow.
He was recording it in a home studio, which in 1991 was pretty novel.
I had no idea that he was so technologically sophisticated.
Well, he's not. I mean, he was, in that he had he and his
interested
people
in it.
Had set up his studio and stuff. Yeah. But So Mark and I just said, "Oh well, we're on the well. You know, you should." So we hooked him up on the, set him up on the well. But yeah, using that Unix conferencing system. So he'd call me up like late at night. He'd call me up.
Gareth.
He calls me up one night. Yeah, and I do a horrible Billy Idol accent. But he calls me up one night and he wants to know how to get into his email. So I should run through the whole thing. Next night, almost the same, and he knew I was late night, so right. He'd call me on the East Coast. It's like 2 o'clock in the morning, and I look, and it's Billy Idol, and he goes, "Gareth, I need you to show me how to get back on the well." And I said, "Billy, I went through all of this last night." And he goes, "I know, but I got home from the studio and I had a doobie." And he had forgotten everything I'd taught him the night before.
Oh, God.
But yeah, but I ended up impersonating him because he was on his European tour for the album. And a Boston rock magazine wanted to do a cyber interview with him, which is basically an email-based interview, but they called it a cyber interview. And again, no one was doing this stuff at the time, so it was kind of a big deal. But he couldn't figure out, which at that time, it's really hard to get on the internet. You had all the sockets and all that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, there was no WinSock on your Windows. You had to add your own WinSock and... Yeah, no TCP/IP stack.
Exactly. So he couldn't figure out how to do that from Europe. And so he ended up – I logged into his email on the well. I got the questions. I faxed them to him in Europe. He wrote the answers out on legal paper and faxed them back to me. But the funny thing was, you know, because – so I'm – sending them, but I started adding little things like "Rock on."
Oh Lord!
I started adding. Little,
I'm gonna give it some Idol personality.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, that's hysterical. Did Billy ever know that you were doing? He must have. He saw the interview.
Oh yeah, no, I'm
he
sure.
Was. He probably didn't remember anyway.
But the article, the piece in the book, which is the first time I've actually told the full Billy Idol story. I think it's really fascinating because I think he really doesn't get his due. He was the first person to put digital content on a record. Mark Frauenfelder and I,
wow.
And Jamie Levy, who's this thing called Electric Hollywood. But we did a HyperCard stack that came with the record. That was really novel. He was one of the first people to basically do social media. I mean, he was putting his well address on all of his display ads for his record. And
he was a precursor.
Absolutely. Oh, God, yeah. As I say, I think he deserves a seat at the table with Brian Eno and David Bowie and a bunch of the other people who are doing really early innovative stuff online.
Yeah, yeah. Wow, how interesting. And now, of course, everybody's on Twitter and they have people like you who do the same exact thing. Basically, they tweet for the...
Well, that was really funny because
you were
sad
first social media
fakes.
Yeah.
But that was the sad thing with Billy because he saw one of the first things he said to me on the first phone call where he called me up and said he wanted to use this content is he said, "The internet is punk rock."
And he's right.
At the time, I just thought that's sort of a vacuous. Like, what does that actually mean? But over time, I realized. He's absolutely right because he came from DIY culture and punk, early punk.
Right.
And he got all these sort of layers of people he becomes an industry. So all of a sudden, here's the thing. He can do the album himself. He can promote it himself, you know, just like my book. It's breaking out of those sort of layers and just doing the thing absolutely yourself. And so that's what was so refreshing to him. But then when I started working with him, and then slowly, as his people caught on to what he was doing, the layers started slowly coming back. And then I didn't talk to Billy anymore. Mm-hmm. I talked to people.
Mm-hmm.
And he wasn't reading his email anymore. His people were. And so it's sort of sad to see that how that happens, where people get so in there. He broke out of his bubble for a while, and then they just put him back in the bubble.
Yeah, it's very – those forces are hard to resist. It's like the tide at some point that just comes back in.
And there's vested interest. I mean, once you become...
Where there's money.
Yeah. It's like the Lady Gaga thing. She might like being a Gaga
her. Yeah, yeah. We're talking with Gareth Branwen. I want to talk a little more about the title of the book and the piece that you wrote about becoming a Borg in just a second. And a reminder, the book is available on Amazon, but the best way to get it is from Gareth's own website, sparksoffirepress.com, because you can get, for the same price, an autographed copy, get the book plate, get all the extra stuff. I love this book plate.
I know.
Really, it's a letterpress, so it's got texture. Isn't it funny how, as we get more modern, we kind of celebrate the old ways in some...
Yeah,
Even a paper book is kind of old-fashioned.
Yeah, no, I really wanted it to be... very tactile.
But you get the illustrations as a result. And is there a Kindle version, or are you going to do
it? Yeah, and I have three digital versions, PDF, Kindle, and the iBook.
But I think you should get the paper book.
Yeah, no, I think it's really made to be a physical experience. Yeah. And I've even had people read the e-book, and then they decided to get the print book, and they said the experience of reading it is completely different.
What is the Gesundheit Institute? What is that?
That was for 10 years. I worked with Patch Adams, the guy.
Oh yeah, the guy with
Williams
the red
movie.
Nose.
Yeah, the red nose guy. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I worked at his institute for 10 years.
How
so
neat!
I was
I didn't
assistant director of that.
So. I didn't know that.
Yep.
Wow. Who played you in the movie?
Nobody. But there was originally a character based on me, Gary. Gareth became Gary. Which is in the original script, but I, ended up on the cutting room floor, so it never happened.
Just made things complicated.
But I was really pushing to have Jeff Goldblum play me. That was fun.
I'd take him. We'll have more with Gary Branwyn in just a second. But first, a word from Personal Capital. Another great story that came from this show. Bill Harris was on this show talking about, he was a former CEO of PayPal and Intuit, and he was talking about money and finance. And he said, I got this little startup maybe you'd be interested in. I signed up right then. That was 2 years ago. And I'm still a huge fan of Personal Capital. Personal Capital helps you understand what's going on with your money. Nothing wrong with that. If you're planning for your future, you need to know not only what you've got, but where your investments are going, how much your investments are costing. If you're paying somebody for advice, you need to know that they're doing a good job and that you're not overpaying for that. Personal Capital can help you with all that free. Free. So the first thing it does is brings all your accounts and assets into a single screen, whether it's your computer, your phone. They have a tablet app. They have they actually have an Android Wear app, so you can look at your Android Wear watch and see how your money's doing, which is pretty mind-boggling. They were, I think, one of the first companies to make an app for Android Wear. You'll know how much you're paying in fees, whether you're overpaying, whether you've got your 401k properly balanced so that it's going to support you in your later years. Take it from me, your later years are not as far off as you think. Sign up today. It takes just a minute, costs you absolutely nothing, and I promise it will pay big dividends. Personal Capital gives you total clarity and transparency so you can make better decisions right away. To set up your free account, go to personalcapital.com/triangulation. personalcapital.com/triangulation. Personal Capital is free and the smart way to grow your money. And we thank them so much for their support of Triangulation. A few minutes left. I'm sorry to say only a few minutes left with Gareth Branwyn. His book, Borg Like Me. Tell me what the title is about. Are you a Borg?
Well, yes. I mean, I think I make the argument in the introduction. I think we're all Borgs at this point.
Yeah,
we're so heavily tech-mediated.
Our sensorium is now extended into the Internet.
Absolutely. I mean, you have a brain annex in your pocket, and we all take different high-end drugs, and we all have corrective lenses, and we all, it's that William Gibson thing of the future is here. It's just not
evenly distributed. Yes.
So, yeah, and I have an artificial hip. Mm-hmm. I have a rebuilt heart. I take a biological. Well, now I do it self-injectable every week. That's made of tweaked mice proteins.
Wow.
For my arthritis.
So when we first met, you were in a wheelchair.
Yep.
You could sort of move around, but you needed a chair to really mobilize
because of my right hip. Yeah. Which
and
I
this
got
is a congenital or a genetic disease.
Yep. Called ankylosing spondylitis, which is basically spinal arthritis.
Right. And you'd had this since you were a teenager.
Since I was like 13, 14 years old. Yep.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but I tell people I'm part man, part machine, and part mouse. So I'm a chimera.
I love that. But I think you're right. I think we all are now. Even if you're not, medicated or have an artificial hip, as you say, in our pocket is some of our memory.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, I say in the book I have a piece that I wrote for my zine Going Gaga in 1993 or whatever, and I said, our machines are getting smaller and smaller, and soon they will disappear inside of us.
Mm.
So it's also that thing of, our tech does tend to get closer and closer. And at
it's
some
happening.
Point, it's absolutely happening.
Now that it's in our pockets, it's just on our eyes and on our wrist, and it's just a matter of time.
Yep, absolutely.
And I celebrate it. I look forward to it. I'm a William Gibson cyberpunk type.
Well, I mean, I am literally animated by technology. The drugs that I take, if I stop taking my drugs, I can't walk. I'm basically bedridden.
No kidding.
Yeah. So I, without my drugs, I'd probably, or certainly without.
But not
the
merely painkillers. They're actually doing something else.
Yeah, the anti-inflammatory. My knees get all swollen up. All my joints get swollen up. I can't move them.
Wow. Is that the mouse protein?
It's everything. I take different kinds of NSAIDs and all. I take a fistful of drugs every day. And I have since I was like 13 or 14 years old. So kind of amazing. My stomach has held out. But but yeah, so I'm here by the grace of science.
Right.
So that's you know, maybe that's why I'm a science and tech writer. I know the
importance
of those.
Yeah,
yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. Are there things that worry you about the directions we're taking? Or are you very optimistic about the future?
Well, I'm an optimist. I'm definitely an optimist. I think that humans always sort of come through in the clutch, and I'm still banking on that.
But we're getting close to the clutch.
But we're clutchy these days,
Kind of the bottom of the ninth.
Yeah, no, it's alarming. There's all kinds of very alarming things, and certainly the internet is one of the things that I'm actually doing right now. After I left MAKE, I got a grant from George Mason University to do a study. I'm a fellow there at George Mason University in outside of D.C. to study the maker movement and its relationship to DIY cultures through the 20th century. So I'm looking at like how these cultures, how these movements come about, how they get subsumed by the dominant culture, and then specifically looking at MAKE, the maker movement, and how that is now starting to become mainstream, and is what's good about that, what's bad about that. But I'm interested in how the internet is potentially a way that John Gilmore from the EFS has this great quote, "The internet reads censorship as damage and routes around it."
And I wish that were true.
What's that?
I wish that were true.
I think ultimately it's as long as this things like net neutrality allows people to
that
rerouting.
Right.
But even things like at Hack DC, and they have a thing called Project Byzantium, which is they're making technology to do ad hoc networking on cell phones. So like if the main
kind of mesh style.
Yeah, basically a mesh net. So if the main net goes down, you just So I think once with that sort of ingenuity and that sort of available technology, I sort of hope there'll always be a way to circumvent any sort of good government control or attempts at censorship.
And that way, that's what Billy Idol was saying. He said the internet is punk. The internet is hackers. The internet ultimately fosters a mentality that of figuring it out and doing it ourselves. And of course, commercial interests move in every case.
Absolutely.
But as long as people continue to act as individuals individualistically, there's some hope.
Yeah, no, and the internet continues to reinvent itself. Yeah. Like blogging just sort of came out of nowhere.
Right.
The whole Web 2.0 thing. We thought the web was kind of dead, after the tech wreck.
Right.
There was a sense of all that stuff had gone away. And then blogging came out, and it just exploded all over again.
Social
networking came out, and it exploded all over again.
But there does seem to be a cycle, because I look at, social networking seems to have taken a turn for the mean. There is this kind of cycle to these things.
Yep.
And so that's interesting. So what maker movements were there before the one we know today?
Well, there's the arts and crafts movement of the turn of the century. And then one of the big ones is, which is very similar to the maker movement, is post-World War II, where all these GIs came back. They had all these skill sets. And then, again, it's similar to the maker movement where things like Arduino, all of a sudden there's available inexpensive technology. So these guys came back from World War II, and then all of a sudden table saws, and you could basically
set
up a
wood shop
in your garage, and then all popular mechanics and all these magazines came out to fulfill that desire.
Right.
But it's very fantastical. Like, we used to have all the back issues of the popular science from that period at MAKE, and you just look through them, and it's stuff you knew they never actually built this stuff. It was just some engineer on his drawing board going, what would be cool is a doghouse that also has an elevator in it. And actually, for MAKE for a while, Mr. Jalopy, who's an amazing guy, an L.A. maker, he had a column in MAKE where he would actually go back to those plans and actually try to make the thing.
Oh, how funny.
And most of them were
half
not really
time, not
makeable.
Doable. Not doable.
So then every movement always has that. There's always kind of a great romantic sort of overstatement of the idea.
Right.
And then so the question I'm asking myself with the maker movement is, how much of it is real,
right.
How much of it will actually impact society and have long-term effects, and is everyone really a maker, and how right. much do people really want to do this, or is it just a fad where you pick it up for a while and then you move on and you...
I would guess that more than half of the people who buy Make magazine never do a project.
Oh, yeah, no, it's way aspirational. They look through and they imagine themselves, right. which, again, it harkens back to the popular mechanics.
Right. Yeah, that's fine.
Yeah, no.
That's inspiring. And there are these fairy tales, the idea that, for instance, and maybe we will have it, a 3D printer garage that will print objects like cars and washing machines. I suppose that's possible.
Yeah, no, replicators. I don't doubt that will be in the future, in the far future.
Far
anyway,
future, but, yeah. Gareth, it's always just nice to talk to you. No, fun to talk to you.
It's a pleasure, Leo.
The book, Borg Like Me and Other Tales of Art, Eros. We didn't get to the arrow so far. And embedded systems.
That's probably a good...
We'll leave that as an exercise for the reader. Sparksoffirepress.com is the place to get your copy, or Amazon as well. And yeah, I think this is a great read. Something to inspire. And you'll laugh and you'll enjoy it. You'll cry
you'll laugh,
a little bit.
You'll cry, you'll fall in love.
Yeah. I don't really fall in love? Okay, I haven't covered that part yet. Well, you'll fall in love with Gareth. Who doesn't love Gareth Branwen? It's so nice to have you here.
It's always
really
a pleasure, Leo.
Thank you, Gareth.
Thank you so much.
We do Triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, 1800 UTC. If you want to join us, we love it if you're here live. But if you can't be, don't worry. We make on-demand versions of all of our shows available at our website. In this case, twit.tv/TRI. We also put it up on YouTube, youtube.com/triangulation. But the best thing to do... Oh, you can also watch or listen on our apps. We have great apps on iPhone, iOS, Android, Windows Phone, Windows 8, Roku. And all of it, not from us, but thanks to our really spirited third-party developers who just say, I think you need an app on the Windows Phone. Thank you, Dimitri. Mm-hmm. People like that. But also the best way to get it is to subscribe in your favorite podcast client like iTunes or Dog Catcher or Instacast. That way you'll get every episode. And I think this is one of our shows where... You shouldn't look at the label. You should just listen, because every show has something interesting. Maybe you don't know from just looking at the name of the show. So subscribe, and that way you'll have them all. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.